I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Teach for America is a national corps of outstanding recent college graduates who commit to teach in our nation's public schools for 2 years. Since its founding 16 years ago by Wendy Kopp, the organization has put more than 14,000 teachers in classrooms and won accolades from the press and from funders. Today's guests are on the front lines of Teach for America, working in Memphis City Schools, the 18th largest district in the country. Brad Leon is heading the program in Memphis. Shelby Royer and Donique Nobles are two of his recruits. They are all about to begin their first day of school, and we'll find out about the challenges they expect to encounter once the students arrive today on Smart City. But first, the news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Brad Leon heads Teach for America in Memphis, where the program is just beginning its first year. Brad began his career with Teach for America as a core member, teaching 7th and 8th graders in New Orleans. Brad, you are a former Teach for America recruit. You had a public policy degree from Occidental College. Why did you decide to become a teacher?
Well, I joined Teach for America, I think, for one main reason. It's because I wanted to really make a difference. And I saw that Teach for America was actively making a difference in 20 different communities across the country. And I wanted to be a part of that. I knew people who had done Teach for America. And the sense that I got from them was that they felt like they were part of something much bigger than themselves. And that's what I was looking for as well.
Where did you teach?
I taught in New Orleans at the New Orleans Free School. And I taught 8th grade language arts and social studies.
How long were you there?
I was there for 2 years, from 2002 to 2004.
How did the other teachers in the school accept you? They had, I'm sure, teaching degrees. Mm-hmm. They must have looked at you with somewhat of a wary eye.
Well, actually, in New Orleans, we've been around for quite a long time, so this wasn't the first time that they had a Teach for America Corps member. But I really took it upon myself. I mean, there were some people who did, and I took it upon myself to really build relationships with everyone. And what the teachers in my school cared about and what I imagine the teachers in Memphis care about is whether their co-teachers are interested in really, you know, teaching their kids. And I was, you know, always the first one there to school. I was the last one to leave. And then when they saw that I was actively working to make sure that my kids had a great education, they accepted me. I mean, I wasn't coming in to the school as a missionary or to, you know, revolutionize what was going on. I was there to work hard and to be a teacher.
They probably expected that you would have a short tenure. Did they resent that in any way?
If they did, they never mentioned it to me. The Teach for America commitment is a 2-year commitment, but what's interesting is that 63% of our alums stay full-time in education. Actually, the executive director of Greater New Orleans for Teach for America taught at the school that I taught at for 8 years. And so I don't think that, I mean, they understood that it was a 2-year commitment that I could leave after 2 years, but many people decide to stay on, so I don't think they were making any assumptions about that.
You had, I presume, no classes in college to prepare you to teach. What surprised you once you got into the classroom?
I don't necessarily think it was anything pedagogical, actually. Teach for America's Summer Institute prepared me well to get in the classroom, so I knew what I was walking into. That being said, I think that I never anticipated how challenging it would be to give my kids an equal chance in life by giving them a great education. Walking into the classroom, I mean, you know what you're going to face. You may face classroom management issues. Oftentimes, you know, the students that we serve are 3 grade levels below grade level. Actually, in my situation, I had 8th graders, and only 30% of them were reading on the 8th grade level. Some were as low as the 2nd and 3rd grade level, and the class average was between the 4th and the 5th grade level. And the bigger challenge, though, was that in the 8th grade, students in Louisiana are required to take and pass a standardized test that's going to move them on to the next grade. And in Louisiana and New Orleans, only 41% of 8th graders actually passed that test. So they weren't going on. And to get my kids in a place where they could be prepared to go on to high school, I knew it was going to take a lot of hard work, but I was very surprised at how much work it was really going to take. I started tutoring programs for 1 hour before school and 1 hour after school. So our day went from 7 a.m. till 4 p.m. We literally had to add 2 hours to the class day because we couldn't get to where we needed to go without adding extra time.
Brad, I noticed that when I go to seminars today as an adult, It's really hard to maintain focus for more than just a few hours, and I think back on the time I spent in the classroom thinking, how did I do it? Is that a problem for kids today? You just said you added 2 hours to the class day.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I just got back from a 5-day conference, so I can understand what you're saying. It's a hard time for me to focus as well. I think that my kids and any kid, I mean, they're full of energy, and a teacher really needs to be dynamic. And not dynamic in that they're, you know, turning handsprings in class, but that they're really changing up what they're doing on a class day to day. I mean, kids in the eighth grade, you're not just going to lecture to them all day because you're going to lose them. You have to find ways to actively engage them. And when you do that, you know, you can keep their attention. But, I mean, it is a long slog. I mean, that's, you're going from August all the way through May every single day. And you need to be really dynamic with your kids. And that doesn't need to mean that you're the most energetic person in the world, but that what you're doing in your lessons is actually changing things up for them so that they're always learning, but they're always engaged as well.
Teach for America now has how many teachers?
Right now, we have about 3,500 teachers in the midst of their 2-year commitment. We have more than 12,000 alumni in all different sectors. 63% of them are full-time in education, and the rest are in business, medicine, policy, law. Actually, the policy chief for the governor of Tennessee, Drew Kim, is a Teach for America alum who was from Southern Louisiana, or who taught in Southern Louisiana before going on to work with Governor Bredesen.
Mm-hmm. And Teach for America teachers are working in how many cities?
25. We just added 3 sites. Memphis is one of our 3 new sites. Connecticut and Hawaii are the other ones.
And you added this year how many teachers?
From last year, we matriculated last year around 2,100 teachers, and this year we accepted and matriculated around 2,400 teachers. We had almost 19,000 applications this year, so the acceptance and matriculation rate was around 12%. It's one of the things that people notice first about Teach for America. You know, 95% of our candidates held leadership positions on campus. The average GPA is 3.5. We only accepted around 12% of them, and that's because we have a really high bar for those we take in.
That is an astonishing rate of application. What attracts top college students to a program like Teach for America? Is this like the domestic peace corps for them? What are they thinking about?
Well, I was a recruitment director actually for 2 years, so this is an appropriate question for me. I don't think that they're seeing it as a domestic peace corps. I think that they're yearning for something that's really truly meaningful, and they want to make a difference. And they want to do it with an education, because I think that we all are starting to recognize this as a society, that education really could be the silver bullet for a lot of issues. I mean, as a country, we need to be committed to equality of opportunity, because that is what we espouse. But it could be the silver bullet for crime, for poverty, for a number of different issues. And I think that college students have really recognized this. They understand that they've got an educational opportunity, and that it's incumbent upon all of us to make sure that everyone has that same opportunity. And that's what I've really found over the last 2 years recruiting for Teach for America.
What, in your opinion, is the lasting value of Teach for America teachers on their schools and then the systems they teach in?
I think it's first student achievement. Studies have shown that Teach for America core members are incredibly effective at making significant gains with their students. And so I think that in and of itself is going to be the lasting change that we have. But as far as on their school and their community, in my school, I was creating these tutoring programs for before school. I was the first one there, the last one to leave. I think really bringing that energy and that spirit that, you know, you're going to have to do whatever it takes is what is going to be the lasting impact in a school.
Is it reasonable to expect teachers who are generally not particularly well paid, mm-hmm. is it reasonable to expect teachers to bring that kind of energy day after day, year after year, over a lifetime?
This is part of what I think makes Teach for America so powerful, actually, because is it fair that teachers are putting in that kind of energy every single day and getting very little monetary reward? Absolutely not. Teach for America has 2 parts to its mission. I mean, the first part is the short-term part, that we're going to significantly increase the academic ability of our kids. But the second part of our mission is that we are going to help shape the prevailing ideology in the country, either in education or in policy or in medicine or in business, so that we as a society begin to value teachers, to work on issues that are affecting kids. And I think that we're actually, you know, one of our initiatives is to make sure that a lot of our alumni who are not staying with an education go into policy so that we can tackle some of these issues, because teachers should be paid more than they're paid. And is it fair? No. But it's the reality right now, and it's something that Teach for America is actively working on by trying to get our alumni into positions of influence so that they can change things like that.
You said that Teach for America teachers have been incredibly effective with student achievement. Can you give me some numbers?
Absolutely. There are a couple studies. First, Kane Parsons, and the latest one was the Mathematica study that showed that our teachers are more effective than other first and second year teachers in math and reading, and oftentimes they're more effective than veteran and certified teachers as well. And the full study I don't have with me, but you can find that on our website or find it on Mathematica's website.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Brad Leon. He is executive director of Teach for America in Memphis. You have how many teachers now in Memphis? It's your first year in Memphis.
Yep.
How many teachers do you have?
50.
50. And there are how many teachers in Memphis City Schools?
Ooh, that's a great question. I know that there are around 100,000 students. I know that there are about 600 to 800 new hires a year in Memphis City Schools, but I don't know the actual number of teachers that exist in the school system.
Okay, so there are 700 new hires. 50 of them are yours.
Yes.
Can you make a difference with 50 teachers out of 700?
Absolutely, you can make a difference. I mean, 50 teachers, our studies have shown, I mean, each Teach for America core member will impact the lives of, on average, 85 kids. Over the course of the 2 years, 170 kids, which is about 8,500 students over the course of 2 years, which could make a huge difference. But to your point, I mean, we need to grow. We need to make an even bigger impact. And that's, you know, we have 50 teachers this year, but look at New York, for example. We have 1,000 core members going into New York City. We're expanding in Houston from 200 core members to 400 over the next year. Same thing in Phoenix. And this is our first year in Memphis, and we need to do a great job so that people can see that we need more Teach for America core members here. And I envision, you know, 5, 6, 7 years down the line that we're bringing in 150, 200 people to Memphis every single year. So the impact in terms of new hires right now is smaller than we'd like it to be, but that's not what it needs to be in the future.
Now, your 50 core members have begun their training. Mm-hmm. What will you teach them this summer before they enter their classrooms?
Well, our training consists of a number of things. I mean, first, they're teaching summer school, so they're actually getting hands-on experience in Atlanta public schools with real students, with mentors. But they're also taking courses, and the courses that they're taking are in classroom management, on instructional planning and delivery, on diversity, community, and achievement, on learning theory, and then finally on teaching as leadership. The teaching as leadership piece is I think the most fascinating piece about our training, because it's the fundamental tenet on which everything that we do is based upon. Teaching as leadership comprises 6 different components. It's setting a big goal, investing students in their influencers to reach that big goal, planning purposefully, executing effectively, working relentlessly, and continuously increasing effectiveness. And our theory is that leadership makes a difference, and teaching is a leadership role. And so not only are we teaching our core members the technical aspects of how to be a good teacher, but we're grounding them in a mindset that you are the key lever in the classroom. There are things that you can control. Your kids may come to school a couple of grade levels behind, but can you really control what they've had in the past? No, you can only control what you can do in the future with them. And teaching as leadership is grounded in that. And then they go through learning teams. So if someone's going to be a high school English teacher here when they come back to Memphis, they're in a content-specific high school English learning team at the Institute. It's a very intense experience for them. They're going from oftentimes 6 in the morning till midnight every single night.
What are their biggest fears as they come closer to entering the full-time classroom?
I suspect my biggest fear when I was walking full-time into the classroom, I was just terrified because I wanted to do a good job. I wasn't terrified because I didn't think I was prepared, because I think I was. I was more terrified because I wanted to do a great job with my kids, and I was concerned that I wouldn't. Any first-year teacher can relate to this, whether they're Teach for America or coming out of the University of Memphis. You are going to have some challenges your first year that you're not going to have in your second year. I was probably working 12 to 16 hours a day during my first year as a teacher, and I think that my hard work was overcoming a lot of the mistakes that I was making, but I was just afraid that I wasn't going to make an impact on my kids, and that ended up not being the case. I was voted Teacher of the Year unanimously by the faculty and staff in my school after that first year, and I think a lot of it had to do with, you know, I was making up for my skills by working really, really hard and reaching out and trying to get the best resources I could possibly get.
Where will they likely have the most trouble?
There are a couple of things, but I think initially it's classroom management. Any new teacher is going to struggle with classroom management because it's really a mindset and an execution gap oftentimes. I mean, any first-year teacher is going to go through that stage where they know what good classroom management is supposed to look like, and they're not seeing it play out in their classrooms. And that's something that I struggled with initially. Even in my second year of teaching, the real challenge was, how do I get my students who are 3-4 grade levels behind up to where they need to be in the course of one calendar year?
Mm-hmm.
And that ultimately is the biggest challenge that our teachers face. Remarkably, I mean, we've been able to have a lot of success doing that over the course of our 15-year career. I mean, this is the National Teacher of the Year this past year, Jason Camras, was a public policy major at Princeton and was never going to go into education. But like me, he was interested in making a difference and went to Washington, D.C., and he stayed in the classroom and was this year named National Teacher of the Year. I mean, people like Jason Camras are what make Teach for America great. I mean, people who would not otherwise have gone into education were it not for this program. We have the people who started KIPP, and we have a KIPP here in Memphis, were Teach for America alums. The executive director of New Leaders for New Schools, which is the principal program here in Memphis, was a Teach for America alum. I mean, we are really bringing a lot of folks into education, talented, smart, driven folks who wouldn't have otherwise been there. And I think that's one of the real things that Teach for America can bring to any community, specifically Memphis.
Why would they not have been there?
They just wouldn't have gone into education.
And why?
That's a deep question, because I think that, per your point earlier, that we don't pay teachers what they're worth. I think that as a society, and those teachers who are listening to this program can really relate to this, we as a society don't value education. We don't value in the way we value an entertainer, you know, with the sort of perks and the respect. And I think that our top college graduates who our core members are, I mean, these are the, we have student body presidents, we have, Shelby Rohr was on the tennis team at Minnesota, and the really high performing people, Teach for America is really channeling into something that resonates with everyone. And part of what makes this country great is that we all believe that education should be given to everyone on an equal basis. And that's not happening right now, and our core members really want to impact that.
You talk about your core members as being the top performers in college, mm-hmm. in sports teams, in leadership roles.
Yep.
I mean, surely there are cultural issues with students that they are then expected to teach, who come from very different economic, social backgrounds.
Yes.
And your recruits must struggle with that. How do you prepare them for that?
That is a struggle. The first thing we do is we recognize, we validate, and we say, look, I mean, we know that in many cases, this is not the experience you've had. And I think that putting that on the table is the first step to that. But specifically within the Institute, we have a whole course, Diversity, Community, and Achievement, which is our DCA session, which is intended to focus on those issues. Differences in race, differences in socioeconomic status. And those are the sessions that are tied into our regular curriculum over the course of their training. And then over the course of their 2 years, I mean, we really, as a staff, our program staff is going to be working to fully develop their skills in DCA, which would be to make sure that they're investing students in their influencers, make sure they're holding high expectations. Because one of the things that always has concerned me about this issue, it's relevant to look at the differences that exist between, you know, our students sometimes and our teachers. But when I went to New Orleans and I was teaching, I was really concerned about this issue. And what I found is that my kids were the same sort of kids that I was when I was growing up. They wanted to be lawyers and doctors and athletes and policymakers. And when it came down to it, was I really all that different from them? That's not to ignore the things that are clearly different, but that's just to say, as a teacher, what you need to do is hold high expectations of your kids. And we believe, without a shadow of a doubt, that every single kid, regardless of where they've started, can achieve on an absolute level. And so we want to recognize those things and talk about them and really deeply engage. But sometimes that becomes an enabler. Sometimes that will enable some people to say, well, my kids are 3 grade levels behind. They've had such a rough home life. Is it really a big deal that they didn't turn in their homework last night? That's what it can become. That's why we as a staff have to say, yes, it is a problem that that student did not turn in their homework. I don't care what their situation is. If they don't turn in that homework, 10 years down the line, they're not going to be going to college. And if they're not going to college, their opportunities are going to be limited. It is incumbent upon us to hold the very highest expectations of our kids, even if they are coming from difficult circumstances and backgrounds. And I think that that is what we mean also by teaching as leadership, is really holding those high expectations while recognizing that there are differences.
In the next 2 weeks, you're going to introduce us to two of your new recruits so we can check in with them from time to time on their experiences in the classroom during their first year. Tell us who they are.
Well, the first person is Danique Nobles. She went to the University of Mississippi, and she's going to be teaching special education here in Memphis. Danique is a fantastic young woman who I just was so impressed with right when I met her. The second woman is Shelby Rohr, who went to the University of Minnesota and was on the tennis team, played tennis on a scholarship at the University of Minnesota, and is going to be teaching middle school math here in Memphis.
Brad, I wish you the very best
success
in your work, and thanks for telling us about it on Smart City.
No problem.
Brad Leon is Executive Director, Teach for America in Memphis. After a short break, we'll visit with two Teach for America Corps members about to begin their first year in the classroom. And we'll talk to Otis White about a surprising new source of urban leadership. Smart City is made possible in part by the support of Memphis Urban Innovators, a collaboration of Memphis business leaders, including the Memphis Regional Chamber, who are focused on bringing smart people, smart ideas, and smart solutions to Memphis in the new economy. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, we talked recently about the difficulty of getting corporate CEOs involved in civic affairs, but you've discovered what may be a new source of civic leadership.
Well, actually, I guess you could call it an older source, because what we're talking about here are retired corporate executives. I focused on one. He happens to be here in Atlanta, where I am. And his name is Pete Carell. He is just stepping down. He's the chair of the Georgia Pacific Corporation, and he is retiring. What is Georgia Pacific? Well, it's a wood and paper products company. You probably, if you know it at all, you know it because it makes Brawny paper towels and Dixie cups, those paper cups that everybody has in their home. The company has been sold. It's gone private, been taken off the stock market, and a lot of people made a lot of money, including, not surprisingly, the CEO, Pete Carell, who came into about $140 million as a result of this sale and some bonuses and some other things. And what's interesting about Carell is not that he's retiring or that he sold the company, but what his plans are after retirement. Turns out he's been a fairly active civic leader in Atlanta for a number of years. And when he was interviewed by the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, he said his big plans for retirement were to become even more involved in the community. He's going to help Emory University here in Atlanta raise a lot of money for its medical college. And he says, I want to continue to be involved, and he's going to start a little family foundation. And when you think about it, these people, these corporate executives, have a lot of things they can bring in their retirement to civic work, organizational skills, the ability to make difficult decisions, and sometimes they arrive like Pete Carell with a little money in their pockets, and that helps too. So all in all, a very good thing, a good source of community leadership, good thing for cities to think about.
Well, you also have Arthur Blank and Bernie Marcus from Home Depot, retirees who aren't acting like it.
No, they have been. They're almost the model for what happens after retirement, the good things that can happen to communities after executives retire. Arthur Blank and Bernie Marcus were the co-founders of the Home Depot company. And Arthur Blank, with his retirement money, bought the Atlanta Falcons football team, and he chaired the Atlanta Chamber of Commerce after he retired. And he's raising a lot of money now to build a symphony hall here. And Bernie Marcus just wrote a gigantic check to build a new aquarium in Atlanta and then endowed it so that it will always be a financially viable institution.
And I understand it's going gangbusters.
It is. I've been to it. It is. I advise folks to go see it. It is, the wow factor at the Georgia Aquarium is pretty intense, and it has been very popular.
On this note of using retired executives in a productive way, Chicago Metropolis 2020 actually makes office space and administrative support available to former CEOs of both foundations and corporations in Chicago area to work on civic projects that interest them, which I think is another very clever way of capturing that energy and that intelligence of younger retirees who want to engage in civic affairs. Kind of a nice idea.
It's a great idea, and it's so much more fun than being on the golf course every day.
Well, I would second that. We may be alone in that assessment, Otis, but I would have to agree with you. We'll talk to you next week.
Thanks, Carol.
Otis White is a regular columnist for Governing Magazine. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Shelby Royer is a recent graduate from the University of Minnesota, majoring in psychology with a minor in youth studies. Shelby earned the Presidential Student Leadership and Service Award her senior year, and while at the university, she founded a community service program entitled MAGIC, Maroon and Gold Impacting the Community. Shelby, what attracted you to Teach for America?
When I first was introduced to Teach for America and I learned about their goal and their mission, at first I just agreed with it and I was like, oh, that's a great thing that they're trying to do. And then I read more into it and I read more about the achievement gap that they're trying to close, and I became very passionate about it after I realized how drastic the achievement gap is and how necessary it is to work towards closing that.
Is there anything in your background, Shelby, that particularly attracted you to teaching or to the mission of Teach for America, closing the education gap?
It's funny that you ask. I was born in Grand Forks, and in my first grade class, I unfortunately didn't have the best opportunities to advance my education. And as a result, we moved around a lot when I was a child, and we moved to Minnesota for second grade. And as a result of my first grade experience, I was really far behind all my second grade classmates. And they even wanted to put me in the special ed classroom, but my parents wouldn't let them. And so then we worked hard to get me caught back up. And then I was enrolled in the gifted classes, and my parents never told me that until I was in seventh grade. And it really, really was very powerful for me to realize that it wasn't because of my developmental capabilities or my brain power or anything. It was just simply because I didn't have the opportunity in first grade. And it goes to show that even though that happens, it's completely possible to catch back up and then, after doing that, excel past where people expect you to be.
What made you think you would be a good teacher?
Well, I think one of the most important parts about being a teacher is caring for the students, having a true, unconditional love for all of your students. And I believe that I have that. I care so much. Even for the 4 weeks that I taught in Atlanta with my students, I became so attached to them right away and cared about them so much and was so invested in their achievement that I think teaching for a year with these students is just, it's just going to be great. And I think that I think kids are very receptive to that, knowing when teachers care about them as individuals and as people.
You were able to maintain your enthusiasm over 4 weeks in Atlanta, but now you have a full year facing you in Memphis. It's going to be a different experience, don't you think? I mean, how do you sustain that sort of love and passion and caring without just becoming totally exhausted?
You're right. It is going to be very different, but I'm very excited about that. It's going to be an immense challenge, and that's what gets me so excited, because I love being able to work hard. I love being able to have a project that I can pour all of my heart into. And this is what's going to be so great about this, is that I have a whole year with these students. Whereas in Atlanta at the Training Institute, you only had 4 weeks, and it was hard. It was a struggle to know that you're going to work 4 weeks with them and then you're going to have to leave. So it's so exciting and encouraging to have a whole year with these students. And I'm sure there's going to be times where you get burnt out, but that's true in any profession. And so it'll be important, you know, to take time for yourself and maybe go outside for a jog, things like that, every day to ensure that you're not getting burnt out, to prevent that from happening.
Tell me what you will be teaching and the school you've been assigned to.
I will be teaching 8th grade math, pre-algebra, and algebra at Hamilton Middle School.
That's a tough age.
Yeah, it is.
They're struggling to become teenagers and grow independent, and yet in some ways they're still kids.
Yep.
Why that age?
Well, I'm very excited about teaching 8th grade. I got to teach 3rd grade in Atlanta, which was so fun. The kids were so excited about it, and they really looked up to you, but they hadn't quite come into their own. And I think 8th grade is going to be great because they're so impressionable at that age, too. So it's really a very critical time in their development to have a positive role models to encourage them and to push them on the right track towards high school and then on to college and things like that. And they have a lot of personality, which I really look forward to, which is, again, going to be a challenging part. But I think that what's unique about me is I have a very strong personality, too, and so I think it's going to go really well with the kids. Oftentimes people wonder how I have so much energy, and I think that's going to – I'm going to challenge those 8th graders with the energy.
Is there anything that remains a mystery to you about getting up in front of a classroom full of 8th graders?
The only thing, maybe, I'm not too worried about being up in front of the classroom, and on my part, I'm nervous about how they're going to receive me, being the Minnesotan girl with my thick Minnesotan accent. I'm nervous that they might pick on me for that quite a bit.
Well, since Southerners are used to being picked on for their accents, turnabout is fair play. Is there anything that intimidates you?
Well, there's a lot if you're honest with yourself, there's a lot to be intimidated about. I mean, it's a new experience. For me, it's a completely new atmosphere, environment. But that's what excites me, too. The intimidating and the scary things are the exciting things all at the same time.
What don't you know that you think you need to know?
I think that it's hard to know, going into a classroom and not having gone in before, exactly how the students are going to react to some of your teaching styles. And I think that's why the learning curve is going to be very steep the first couple of weeks. I am going to learn a lot about myself and about my teaching style within those first 2 weeks, what works, what doesn't work, what I've planned that maybe I need to rethink, go back and change a little bit. It's hard to be able to know before you go in without the actual experience. It's a learning process. So,
I just read a several-part piece that the Sun-Times did following an outstanding teacher in the Chicago public schools. She had moved from one school to a new school, charter school, run by the University of Chicago. So great credentials coming in. But the year absolutely exhausted her, and most of it was classroom management. The exhausting part for her was the problems that kids brought into the classroom. They were working hard to create a mixed income school, and kids coming from particularly public housing, very low income circumstances, not all of them by any means, but a number of them were really having issues like fighting and skipping school and truancy and all those family problems. It was really a very sad story to read. Have any of your colleagues in Teach for America run into those kinds of things where they entered the classroom with great enthusiasm, feeling confident that they could teach, and yet the behavioral problems just overwhelm them?
I think that that is not an uncommon situation to find yourself in, and I think the important thing is learning is the way you handle that situation, because the reality of the situation is that might be probably what you're going to come across, at least with a few students, and so you need to be very conscious that and know going into it to expect those things and not try not to be naive about it. And I think what's important is to develop a relationship, a personal relationship with those students, so you can help them as much as you can, and when they walk into your classroom, they know that it's a classroom and it's a place for as long as they're in there that they're going to be safe. It's going to be structured. They're going to have structure. They're going to be safe. They're going to be able to be themselves. It's going to be okay to make mistakes and to learn and to try to do everything you can to create that environment within your classroom, which is what you need to do the first couple of weeks, I believe. You need to do that right away because you can't go back and change it. And know that these kids come in here with all different stories. You can't teach to a classroom. You have to teach to the individuals that are in the classroom. And I think that's what's very important about what a lot of us in Teach for America are trying to do.
My sister's a teacher, and I know she's going to a new school this year in the same system, Memphis City Schools. She's been in her classroom this week getting it all ready. Have you been doing the same thing?
Well, I just got into Memphis yesterday, but back home in Minnesota, I recruited a couple of my friends who are very artistic to help me make a couple posters.
And so is that necessary? If you're a teacher, you have to know how to make posters or have friends that do.
It's true, and I do not have the best handwriting. If you ask anyone I know, they'll tell you the same thing. So I recruited a couple of my girlfriends from back home to help me make these posters. So I'm going to plan on going to my class tomorrow and get the keys and start decorating it.
How long do you expect to teach?
You know, that's a great question. I don't know exactly how long I'll be in the classroom for at least 2 years here in Memphis, but I am thinking that after these 2 years of teaching, it's going to be very, very hard for me just to wash my hands of the education program altogether. And I could very easily see myself teaching for some more years or even going on and becoming a principal or something with education policy, something with that I'm dealing with the students in the school systems.
What do you expect this experience to do for you?
Well, I've only been a part of it for 2 months, and it has already changed my outlook on so many things. It forces you to think about topics and situations that you wouldn't naturally come across unless you're put in this situation where, for the first time, I'm a minority, which is, you know, you don't come across that. I didn't come across that in Minnesota, so that's very eye-opening, and to realize how you deal with new situations that you're not put in. And it's just really, I've become so passionate about the achievement gap. Working firsthand with the students who are affected by it down in Atlanta, I tell my friends about it when I go back home, and I get so heated when I talk about it now. And I've been trying to recruit people that I think would be great in this program too, and just telling them about it, making them aware of what's going on in these school systems away from where we grew up.
What if you fail? What if your students fail?
That's a tough question. My personality is the type where I don't let myself fail. I work as hard as I need to achieve the goals that I've set for myself. And the only thing I can do is be hopeful that the situation is going to reflect that as well. Sure, outstanding circumstances could arise that would maybe cause that situation to happen, but all I can do is pray and hope and do everything within my power to not let that happen. It's, for me right now, it's not even an option. I mean, that thought doesn't cross my mind because I wouldn't accept it. I wouldn't stand for it. I wouldn't be able to sleep at night knowing that there could be more I could be doing to help my kids.
Shelby, I'd love to talk to you in about 6 weeks. Will you come back and tell us about your experiences?
It would be my pleasure.
Good luck in this first 6 weeks, and we'll talk to you soon.
Thank you very much.
Thanks, Shelby.
Yep.
Donique Nobles earned her baccalaureate degree from the University of Mississippi, where she majored in physics and minored in English and mathematics. Donique was a Mississippi Alliance for Minority Participation scholar. Donique, you've been assigned to what grade in what school?
I'm at Fraser Elementary, grades 4 through 6.
Now, have you been to your classroom?
Not my classroom, but I met my principal, and she's wonderful.
Oh, that's good. And what will you be teaching?
I'll be teaching special education.
Really?
Yes, ma'am.
Now, there's a challenge. How do you go from no special training and special education at the university to being in a special ed classroom?
Well, this summer at Institute, which, you know, is our rigorous training, I had special education training there, workshops, all kinds of things that we did there. It's just a matter of, I know that all children are children, regardless of what kind of classroom they're in. So it's just a matter of me helping them a little bit more.
What was your major in college?
My major was physics.
Physics?
Yes, ma'am.
And you're teaching special ed?
Yes, ma'am.
This should be interesting.
It will be.
I'm surprised they didn't put you to work as a physics teacher.
I know. When I did my Teach for America application, I checked that I would teach special education. Because it is a critical need subject, but so is math and science, I do believe. But I observed special education classrooms, and I really, really, like, my heart was just in it, and I knew that that's where I wanted to be.
Why?
Just because the feel in the classroom was totally different. The children just kind of clung to me. Like, I was pulled on the carpet and played, and, you know, I helped and everything. And my heart just, I knew that that's where I wanted to be.
As you went through the Institute this summer, tell me what you learned. What did you concentrate on in the Institute?
We concentrated on pretty much best teaching practices, whether that's classroom management, teaching styles, just a variety of different things. Most of all, I think that I concentrated on classroom management because for me, I went in thinking that, you know, okay, you're going to say X and they're going to do Y. And that's really not how it goes all the time. And so for me, that was my challenge.
And what did you learn about classroom management that makes you confident now that you can go in and manage fourth and through sixth graders?
The most important thing is to be consistent and be firm.
It's like being a parent, isn't it?
Yes, ma'am.
Did you teach this summer?
Yes, ma'am.
For 4 weeks?
Yes, ma'am.
And what did you teach this summer?
I taught second grade, so I taught reading, comprehension, phonics, as well as math.
What were the big surprises to you, Donique, as you entered the classroom and as the weeks passed? What did you feel you learned during that time with students?
I felt like, for me, to just understand that, I guess, children are children. I also learned that you need to expect the best because basically they'll do what you expect for them to do. And if you expect bad things, they'll do bad things. So you have to go in with that mindset of expecting the best, and they do the best.
And when they don't do the best, what will you do?
It just depends on what field that's in. Maybe if it's not the best on maybe a math test, then I'll give them that support and that help that they need to do best on the next test.
And what if they don't do their best in terms of behavior? What are your options as a new teacher in terms of discipline?
It's just a matter of whatever rules I set and whatever consequences I set to always follow that, but also to have positive reinforcement so that they won't always feel like I'm just being mean to them or just being unfair. But I also want to recognize the good things because children, just as well as adults, they love praise. Mm-hmm. So as long as you focus on and hone in on that good aspect, they always tend to come around and do good.
I ask your colleague, Shelby, this. Is there anything that remains a mystery to you about getting up in front of a classroom full of fourth to sixth graders?
To be honest with you, I really don't think so. But I know that that's one of the things that you have to really be in this situation. You know, I've never been in front of fourth through sixth graders before. I did second graders. So it's just a matter of getting in there and then realizing, okay, well, I don't know how to do this, and finding the help to do it.
How will you interact with your Teach for America core teachers throughout the year?
I know that we're all going through the same type of process. So if I can support them in any way, I'm willing to do that, and vice versa. And I know that it's going to be some days when I come home, which my roommate is a Teach for America core member as well.
Oh.
So it's just a matter of all I really, really, really want from us, this Charter Core in Memphis, is support.
Will you meet with them on a regular basis throughout the year?
Oh, yes, ma'am. We have, besides all of that, like social things, we have many professional development things that we have to do throughout the year and meet together. So, yes, ma'am, we'll meet often.
Why were you attracted to teaching and specifically to Teach for America? I'm curious, if you're attracted to teaching, why didn't you study to be a teacher and go the traditional route?
Right. When I went to college, I, of course, had no expectations of being a teacher. I wanted to go into the medical field. And so even my senior year in college, I was on track to go to school in Miami. And I met with Mary Chastain, who was my Teach for America recruiter. And it's just something about it. She just touched my heart. And I knew, like I said, that this is where I needed to be. Now, I don't know what God has in store for me after this. If I stay in the field, that's fine. I'll be more than happy to. But I know that right now, this is where I'm supposed to be. It's all about that change, you know, and I want to be able to help give every child a choice.
So when you say choice, you mean a choice of going to college or a choice of not going to college or where they go? Tell me about choice.
Choice in that college, work, vocational school, just whatever they want to do in life. I want them to be happy and productive.
Is there anything that has surprised you to date about your experience with Teach for America?
To be honest, I was kind of surprised at the intensity of Institute. That's probably the only surprise. I mean, everybody has been wonderful. I love Bradley, Leon, our executive director. Everybody has just been so welcoming. So the only thing I can say is the intensity of Institute.
What will make your experience with Teach for America a success for you? What is it you're trying to get from this experience?
For me, it's a learning experience. Like, I want to teach my students, but I also want to learn from them. I want my students to feel welcome in my classroom. I want them to be able to make mistakes and get up and try again. I want their families to know that I'm here for them. I'm willing to help any way that I can. So if I can look back on this, maybe, you know, 6 years from now, when my students are graduating high school and know that I taught them and they learned something from me, I'll be happy.
How old are you?
I'm 23.
23.
Yes, ma'am.
And you're going to have parents come in to your classroom. You hope you will.
Yes, ma'am.
And yet they may be skeptical of a 23-year-old. How do you establish your presence and your authority with them?
Just by letting them know. I think that parents need to know that you love their child just as, you know, just like they love their child. And just by showing them that I'm there, by making phone calls home, not only when the child needs help or has, you know, done something wrong in the classroom, but also when they made an A on that test or when they've tried their best, I want them to know that I'm observing and I'm seeing the good things as well. Because parents, I know, because my mom loves to hear praises about me, and they need that too. So I just want, you know, for them to know that I'm there and I'm willing to help and I want to help.
You're inevitably going to have children who come from difficult home circumstances.
Right.
How can you as a teacher help them with their family circumstances or help their families provide a more supportive environment for your students?
I think that first I want to establish an open line of communication. I don't want a parent to think that I'm overstepping my boundaries in any way. And I think that once you establish that, that opens doors for many, many different things. And if a parent comes to me and, you know, needs help, or if a child comes to me and needs help, I'm willing to do that. So I just think that first and foremost, it's about opening that door of communication.
You said you've met your principal.
Yes, ma'am.
Female or male?
She's female.
Female.
Yes, ma'am.
How does she feel about having someone come into her school, take over a classroom, mm-hmm. who has not had a traditional teaching background?
Mrs. Price is very, very, very supportive. She was very excited when she met me at my interview, and she told me that she'll support me in any way, form, or fashion, and she really believes in me, as well as Teach for America. They told her a little bit about Institute and, you know, how things are done there. And so, you know, she was very excited about that, and she feels like I'm a new teacher just like anybody else is. You know, whether or not I majored in education or not, she told me that, you know, she's going to support me, and I do believe her.
Donique, I wish you very good luck as you enter this challenge. I want to talk with you and Shelby in a few weeks, maybe at the end of the first 6 weeks, to see how you're coming along.
Okay.
Okay, good. We'll talk again. Thanks, Donique.
Okay, you're so welcome.
Shelby Royer and Donique Nobles are core members of Teach for America in Memphis. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Since the beginning of human history, our insatiable curiosity has driven us to explore the universe and our place in it. City View's commentator Walker Smith explains that it is equally important how we frame this newfound knowledge.
Two recent stories in the New York Times point to some interesting times ahead that we need to face up to today. One is about a team of researchers collaborating to reconstruct the genome of the Neanderthals who lived in Europe from 300,000 to 30,000 years ago. Early testing has shown that enough DNA can be recovered from skeletons to map the entire genome. The objective is to plot the differences between humans and Neanderthals, particularly for things like language, and to use whatever lessons are learned for the contemporary study of human ethnic groups. What really got my attention, though, was the fact that once the genome has been reconstructed, it will be possible to insert it into a human egg for a human mother to give birth to a Neanderthal infant. In 9 months, Neanderthals could be brought back from extinction. A few days later, the Times published another story about an animal breeding project still underway that was started by a Soviet scientist in 1959 to study animal domestication. By breeding animals selected for their tolerance of human contact, in just a few generations, foxes, otters, minks, and even rats have become tame, friendly, and affectionate. They make excellent house pets. At the same time, these researchers bred a parallel set of animals selected for their aggressiveness. These animals have become fierce and vicious. The rats are so ferocious that they go berserk if handled and hurl themselves against the bars of their cages when people come near. The purpose of this research is to study the genetics of domestication. It may also provide some clues about the differences between humans and other more violent primates, and the role of inheritance for violence in humans. Both of these projects raise enormous ethical issues. Suppose, said Dartmouth ethicist Ronald Green, we discover that Neanderthals were wrongly pushed into extinction by humans. Would we not then have an obligation to restore them to life, even if that means bringing back a species inherently competitive with humans? Similarly, if we learn that certain sites on the genome correlate with tameness or violence, would we then have an obligation to use social policy to select against violence? As we delve deeper into the basis of life, we quickly run up against tough questions about the essence and character of life itself. We cannot avoid these questions through inaction. Whatever the genetic issue, whether it's something for the future like Neanderthal DNA or something we face today like stem cells, if we refuse to act, we surrender our leadership position, thus allowing others to pioneer uses and applications. In this void, rogue scientists and ambitious nation-states will have free rein to set the agenda. To control it, we must first master it. Old policies and ethics may not be sufficient for the new genetics, in which case we will need responsible new ethics, not continued inaction. Otherwise, we will face these new realities with none of the benefits, but all of the perils. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to listen to archive shows, sign up for podcasts, and register for our weekly newsletter. Smart Cities web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, a national network of urban leaders working to speed innovation in cities. Information at ceosforcities.org. National distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundations, investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Eric Rudd is our co-producer and engineer. I'm Carol Coletta.